From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Mike Waters, and this is Options. One of the results of the downturn in our economy has been growing economic problems for our nation's cities. There is a real possibility of severe budget deficits. Currently, New York is the outstanding example. Many economists feel it will require federal assistance to return the city to solvency. On Options Today, NPR reporter Bill Green will be exploring some of the financial problems of cities.
When recession hits the city, it hits hard first and leaves last.
And I am now laying off policemen and sanitation men and other people because we have to reduce services.
And that's bound to affect San Francisco and is bound to affect every city.
If New York should default...
I believe default is avoidable if the necessary steps are taken.
New York needs some breathing time.
These cities are not guilty of fiscal irresponsibility.
The recent downturn in the national economy has put a dent in just about everybody's pocket. In simple language, not enough money to pay those monthly bills. Without a doubt, the effects of a national recession is having its most severe effect upon many of the nation's cities. Massive layoffs, cutbacks in social services, increased city taxes, and strikes by public employees are all elements of an ill force which is pushing many cities in the direction of default and possibly bankruptcy. In times of economic hardships, voters turn to their elected officials for remedies. But presently, there is little evidence that the federal government is moving full steam ahead to avert the worsening fiscal crisis faced by many cities. On the contrary, some observers say that Congress and the White House have lost interest in the economic survival of the cities. They complain that energy and foreign relation issues, the CIA and domestic spying, sprinkled with presidential politics, seem to dominate the legislative and executive billboards on Capitol Hill. In this report, we'll examine some of the reasons why cities are in such dire financial shape, their future, and the growing concern for their survival. Alan Beals is executive director of the National League of Cities. Beals outlined some of the short and long-term problems presently faced by many cities.
The longer-term problems have to do with the whole need for a broader revenue base in our cities. Cities have historically been dependent upon the property tax for the bulk of their city revenues. Some three-quarters of all the city revenues in the country come from the property tax. There are a lot of difficulties with the property tax. It's not directly related to ability to pay. It tends to be less responsive to shifts in national economic policy than other forms of taxation and so forth. So in the longer term, cities are and need a broader tax base than the traditional property tax. A number of our efforts have been geared toward looking at that question. Our support for general revenue sharing is an issue that is related to the use of the federal income tax, which is more responsive, more progressive from a standpoint of city revenues. So the income tax obviously is an area where there is a more responsive tax system. Very few cities have the power to levy a local income tax. They perhaps get revenues from the state, and most of the states now do have an income tax. But again, that is not as progressive as the federal income tax, so that the leadership of cities over the years have looked to the federal government as one way of dealing with this longer-term issue because it does have the most progressive tax system. And a lot of our national legislation for cities and our support for it derives from this longer-term tax question. The short-term, there are a number of issues facing cities. Obviously, the most critical one right now is the whole condition of the bond market brought about by the New York City situation. And there's no question that from the short-term point of view, cities are across the country are affected by the New York City and the state of New York now general bond and credit situation.
Alan Beals, Executive Director of the National League of Cities. The short and long-term problems facing cities today are also underscored in a survey of state and local government finances released last May by the Joint Economic Committee. Ralph Schlosstein is an economist working with the staff of the Joint Economic Committee. Schlosstein said that one of the major findings of the survey showed that the fiscal problems of cities are directly related to the impact of the recession.
By that I mean the higher the unemployment rate, the more likely the city is to be in a budget squeeze. Now, this occurs for a number of reasons. The high unemployment affects the revenues of the cities. The taxes go way down because incomes are down, people are paying less income taxes, sales taxes are down because consumers are spending less money, and property tax receipts tend to fall off because people who are unemployed are more likely to go delinquent in their taxes. And yet, at the same time, you see the demands on the city increasing. Unemployment-related expenditures such as welfare, public health, tend to increase. And plus, people who are even middle-income tend to put their kids in more municipal-oriented facilities. For instance, a family is more likely to send their child to a state university or a city university than to put them in a private college. Or they're more likely to put their children in the municipal swimming pool for the summer than to send them to the country club.
Your survey also pointed out that in some cities there were budget deficits totaling as much as $340 million. How did this occur?
Well, the reason it occurs is that most cities, because they are required to operate with balanced budgets, try to enter each year with a small surplus or a contingency fund that they can use throughout the course of the year should the economy turn particularly bad. Well, we found that these cities entered the last year with a surplus of $340 million. However, during the course of that year, because of the downturn in the economy, that surplus was completely depleted and in fact was turned into a deficit. So you have a situation where the economy downturn was so bad that all of the contingency funds were used up and cities were forced to go into the red.
What does this mean to the average taxpayer, say, in terms of dollars?
Well, our survey found that there was a total of about $8 billion that would be taken out of the economy either through tax increases or through expenditure cutbacks. For the average taxpayer, it means probably slightly higher taxes, and it means less services. It means fewer trash pickups. It may mean a little larger classrooms in the school, things of that sort. In many ways, the difference may not be that perceptible, except in the worst areas. And take a situation such as Detroit, where the unemployment rate is 24-25%. There, the city has been forced to take really draconian measures, and they've reduced their workforce by 20%. Police services, fire services, sanitation services are all greatly reduced. It's a real decline in the standard of living in that city. It was interesting, in fact, that we found that the financial problems were not necessarily related to bigness or smallness, but rather to the severity of the recession. So we found that even in the smallest cities of 10,000, 20,000, 30,000, if they had high unemployment rates, that they had very severe financial problems.
Some people may find it difficult to digest the large deficits and the association between a revenue and expenditure. So once these things are digested, how would you summarize or assess the fiscal problems of cities today?
Well, I think you're facing two problems. One is the short-run problem with the recession. And as far as I'm concerned, it'd be very difficult to get a number of our cities back into financial health without a strong recovery in the economy, a return to 5% or 4% unemployment. They simply are not going to receive the revenues in order to cover their expenditures with unemployment rates as high as they are. So that's the number one problem. We have to get the unemployment rate down and get the country back on the road to recovery. The second and more long-range problem is the fact that cities are facing a real mismatch in that they are losing a lot of their fiscal resources, either through jobs that are leaving the city or from middle and upper income people that are leaving the city. So you have a situation where the fiscal resources of the city are taking leave and leaving behind the people who are more dependent on city services and demand greater city services. So in the long run, you have this trend developing which has many of our older central cities unable to finance the demands made upon their services.
Why is it that in some cases like Tulsa and Phoenix and Dallas in particular, you have situations that the city is not faced with any severe fiscal problems? What conditions exist there that you don't find in other cities?
Well, first of all, they have lower unemployment rates, which is a great advantage in the current economic climate. But perhaps even more important, cities in the far west and in the southwest have, because of their state governments, rather liberal annexation policies, which means that they can go out and, as the metropolitan area grows outside of the city limits, they can extend their city limits to incorporate new growth areas in the region. So you see a situation where middle-income families may have moved out of Phoenix into a suburban area, but as that area grows, the city of Phoenix will expand its boundaries and include that suburban area, so they don't lose any of the financial resources that you find fleeing the central cities in more in older areas. In the older areas, the problem is that they are surrounded by incorporated jurisdictions already. There's townships and smaller cities and counties that surround our major cities, and all of those have political structures in them and bureaucracies that are very much entrenched and aren't going to give up the power that they have. And moreover, probably they don't want to anyway, because they're wealthier than the central cities and they don't want to share the goods.
Ralph Schlosstein, an economist working with the staff of the Joint Economic Committee. The sound of the city has a mystic, sometimes rejuvenating effect that allows some city residents to touch the energies of life's constant struggle to survive just one more day. This is the sound of New York City, the Big Apple, the 5 o'clock rush at Times Square, snow cones in Central Park, Harlem number runners dressed like Wall Street brokers. In today's modern world, New York City is cemented by massive clouds of air pollution and too many automobiles that somehow seem to have outgrown the city's streets. There's something else that New York City has outgrown, its ability to pay its bills. The city comptroller has the job of keeping an eye on the city's expenditures. Harrison Golden is the comptroller for New York City, and he explained some of the reasons why the city is on the brink of default.
The politicians who developed the tricks and all of the devices that built in the seeds of disaster bear a measure of the blame. So does the media, the press, which heralded those sleights of hand as representing mathematical ingenuity or fiscal wizardry, when all those steps were was delaying until tomorrow what should have been the problems of the day on which those tricks were used. The banks are to blame because they made money off of the devices that were developed. The citizens generally and business are to blame because they wanted a free lunch, wanted more service without paying for it. There's plenty of responsibility, plenty of culpability to go around.
So what can we learn from, say, New York's problem as it experienced some sort of adjustments to reform itself?
First, that localities have to live within their means. They're not the federal government, which can create deficits, finance them either by borrowing or by printing more money. State and local government can only spend what it takes in, and it's got to be restricted to that. That's the first. Second, that tricks and gimmicks that are calculated to disguise what's going on only build in disaster. And third, that oversight and review and independent examination and scrutiny are absolutely critical to ensure the integrity of the process.
Now, at this point, how optimistic are you about New York City moving towards solvency and eventually solving its fiscal problems?
Well, I'm hopeful that now that the city is finally beginning to confront its intrinsic credit problem, is finally beginning to take the tough steps under the impetus of the state to bring its budget into line with its revenues, that we have a real shot now of making it not only through December, but making it long term.
Harrison Golden, comptroller for New York City. The optimism expressed by Golden is shared by Herbert Ellish, executive director of Big Mac, the Municipal Assistance Corporation. It's Big Mac's job to try and convince investors that the city is making every possible effort to balance its budget. Ellis says it's difficult convincing investors that the city is no longer a credit risk. He discussed some of the steps New York has taken to regain its solvency.
There have been several initiatives that have been taken. I think the most significant one now is in effect, placing the responsibility for city finances in a totally new governmental structure, which is composed of the mayor and the city controller, but in addition to that, the governor and the state controller and three eminent business leaders in who have their main offices in the city of New York. That structure, quite simply, takes all of the city revenues and will give the city as much money as the city will need under a financial plan which that new structure, the new Emergency Financial Control Board, must approve by the 20th of October. And under that plan, it is clear that there cannot be more expenditures than revenues, and that the budget of the city of New York will have to be in balance under very stringent accounting principles by the end of the fiscal year 1977-1978. So in other words, there is a control mechanism, sort of somebody else has their hand on the financial throttle now to prevent the city from spending more money than it has. The legislation is very clear on that. The people who are running the board are very clear on that. The other thing that's happening is that there is a very significant new management initiative in the city government. The basic problem has been for many, many years that the city is not well managed. It is a bureaucracy where management, cost control, getting the most efficiency for the expenditures has not been paid much attention to at all. City commissioners have not managed to a bottom line, so to speak, have not had a budget that they have had to meet, and that is all been changed. The mayor appointed an advisory committee of excellent private sector managers who are going to give him advice on how to do that. There will be new systems put into effect in the city to ensure that the management will improve. That will be modeled on private sector examples. And the third thing that has happened recently is the mayor appointed a new deputy mayor for finance, who was the chief financial officer of JCPenney, a very eminent person in his field, who will now, from the city side, control the finances, have the relationship with the new Emergency Financial Control Board. And all of those things together are really tightening the reins and ensuring that the city will, in fact, live within its income. And there is going to be very difficult times for the city. There are going to be very drastic steps that are going to have to be taken, but the law requires and the people now require that those steps be taken.
Now, under the latest rescue plan passed by the state legislature, the city government relinquishes some of its budgetary authority. How does this affect the intergovernmental relationship between city and state?
Well, what I think it does is make the city and state more, I would say, partners than they used to be. Clearly, the state now has a much closer control over the finances of the city. The management of the city and how the departments run and the various policy decisions, the social and economic decisions as to what service is going to be provided, remain with the mayor. But the governor is now much more closely involved in terms of the finances of the city, and that is clearly understandable because the city is so much a part of the state. And what happens to the city is going to affect the state's ability to finance its obligations. And therefore, the state has not only an interest, but a real stake in what happens here. And I think I might say that the federal government ought to really understand it has the same kind of stake, because eventually, or not really so eventually, if the city cannot get its way, find its way out of this problem, the entire nation is going to be affected by what happened to the city. I mean, this is the premier city of the United States by everyone's understanding, the center of the financial and cultural activity of the United States, and any thought that a default by the city of New York can be isolated, I think, is foolish.
Now, what can we look to happen as a result of some of the reform measures, say, in ways of social impact upon the various people who depend upon the city?
Well, it's really hard to say at this point. The city is required to propose an expenditure plan, a financial plan, to the new control board by the 15th of October. Part of that exercise will decide what services will have to be reduced, where can you get more efficiencies and not reduce the same level of service, what functions that the city provides should it not provide. I think that the first effort would likely be to look at those things which may duplicate activities of other governments, or things where the effect will be minimal. But it is likely that there will be a noticeable effect, and that those services that the people of the city of New York have come to expect, they will not get, in some cases, at the same level. What those are, I think we can't say yet.
Herbert Ellish, executive director of the Municipal Assistance Corporation. Some economists believe that one of the reasons for New York's fiscal nightmare is the expensive price tag attached to local union contracts demanded by public employees. They contend that the increased salaries of public employees have placed a heavy burden on the city's purse. Victor Gottbaum is president of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees Local Union in New York. Gottbaum disagrees with this assumption.
Take the percentage of personnel costs of the budget now as it was some time ago. So that in New York City, it's always been around 60%. In other words, our increases haven't been any greater than the budget itself. Everything is going up. I also remind those people that New York City, in terms of major cities, is only fourth in terms of wages. San Francisco is higher, Los Angeles is higher, Detroit is higher, Chicago is higher. And if you take the cost of living in New York and real wages, New York falls to around ninth.
The city's public employees unions have agreed to a suspension of salary and wage increases for 1 year. Now, would you encourage other public employees, say, in other cities where cutbacks are needed, to submit to a similar agreement?
No, we had a wage deferral letting the city use the money for 1 year. Would I agree to others doing it? No. I don't think others have a problem of a $13.1 billion deficit as New York has. As I mentioned to you, I think we need some short-range therapy that to help us carry over the long range. So the unions have sacrificed in this kind of crisis, but certainly in San Francisco, Chicago, or Detroit, or these areas, it's not necessary. Newark, which is really a disaster area, I don't know what is necessary. I really think my big recommendation would be to throw the rascals out of Washington and get some sensitive men there who are sensitive to the needs of the poor and starving cities. You don't have it now with Burns, Ford, Rockefeller, and Simon. That's really your answer if you want the truth. We're sacrificing only because we can't get these short-sighted human beings to look ahead. You read the obscenity in the daily news and in the media about the workers living off the fat of the land. Our members can't make it on $10,000, $12,000, $15,000 a year in New York. They just can't make it. So they're taking the beating. They're carrying it. The banks, on the other hand, are making profits from 25 to 65% while the workers' real wages are going down. This is the disgusting disgrace of our society. This is the disgusting disgrace of a William Simon. This is what we're living with.
Victor Gottbaum, president of New York City's local union of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. The financial plight of New York City has begun to echo among the chambers on Capitol Hill. Congress and the White House are slowly beginning to seriously seek new answers to the ancient question of how to save the dying American cities. New York officials have worn a path to and from the White House in their trek to hustle up enough money to avoid default next December. The most recent visit was made by Mayor Abraham Beam during his testimony last week before the Joint Economic Committee. Mayor Beam told the committee that New York is not looking for a handout. However, he said the city will not be able to regain its solvency without federal assistance.
I think most of you know New York City actually probably sends some $14 to $15 billion to the federal government and gets back a little over two, so that we are doing our share in keeping this country together. We've been told, that the city and the state should take care of its own problems. Well, we have. The state, several weeks ago, enacted legislation which will make available to New York City a little over $2 billion coming from state advances as well as the use of funds out of public pension systems and other sources, which will take us through November 30th. In connection with that legislation, there was created an emergency control board in which I consented to give up fiscal powers that the mayor has, because I felt that that legislation was important in order that we have the wherewithal to render services to the people of our city. Standards and Poor's has indicated, in terms of the state, that if they do anything much further than that, their fiscal integrity is going to be in danger. We've made tremendous sacrifices. We've cut our services, our budget, by $1 billion. Which included $400 million reductions due to layoffs of city employees. We've instituted a wage freeze. We've gotten out of the contracts of the unions benefits which they have fought for years to acquire. We've committed ourselves to a ceiling on expenditures over the next 3 years, not in excess of 2% of our controllable expenditures. We've increased the fare in the city of New York, despite the fact that it was a very bitter pill for me to swallow in the by reason of the fact that we fought so hard among the mayors to get a federal transit subsidy to keep the fares down. We've increased the fares from 35 to 50 cents, an increase of 43%. We've discontinued the practice, which has been in existence for many years, of paying for operating expenses by the issuance of bonds through capital, through our capital budget, and not only discontinue the practice, but begun the shift of these items back to the expense budget at the rate of $50 million a year. We've put in a freeze, almost a total freeze, on all new construction. We've taken every conceivable step possible to satisfy the investing public and the federal government that New York City is ready to sacrifice anything in order to get the help necessary to continue rendering vital services to our city. Notwithstanding all these actions, and even after we were praised highly by the, and for the first time, by the New York City financial community for taking these steps, unfortunately, The market is still closed to us.
During his testimony before the Joint Economic Committee, Mayor Beam had the support of 14 other mayors who warned that if New York defaults on its obligations, it would severely impair the financial stability of all cities. The president of the U.S. Conference of Mayors, Moon Landrieu of New Orleans, said that as a result of New York's drain on the bond market, other cities have had to pay higher interest rates for the sale of municipal bonds. Mayor Coleman Young painted a similar picture of Detroit.
First of all, I believe that all mayors here look upon New York's problem as symptomatic of a national crisis in American cities. Indeed, a national urban crisis that's been too long overlooked here in Washington. The impact of New York's crises obviously spreads far beyond the borders of that city and that state, and has a very telling effect on all other cities. I can cite my own city's example, for instance, and as has been pointed out, it does not matter to the bond market whether cities have taken steps in order to correct their situation or whether they have not. In Detroit, for instance, we have within the last 18 months reduced the number of our public employees from 25,000 to 20,000. That's a 20% cut in services to our people. We've taken every economy measure that we can, and yet, as we have approached the bond market with over the last year, we found that the imminence of the crisis in New York City has affected our ability to sell our bonds. Never prior to 1974 did Detroit pay in excess of 6% on its general obligation bonds. As we approached the market last year, already with rumblings of the New York crisis, we found we were unable to float bonds within the 8% limitation that our state legislature imposes upon us. We were forced to withdraw those bonds, go back to Lansing, our state capital, get the ceiling raised to 10%, again approach the bond market on a $30 million issue where we paid 9.8. We need more money, and we'll need within the next 6 months. We cannot legally pay the 11 and 11.5 that's being demanded now.
Mayor Coleman Young concurred with the proposals offered by the U.S. Conference of Mayors that the government provide federal guarantees of municipal bonds or provide emergency federal loans to cities on the brink of default. The mayor's proposal for assisting the cities appears to be worlds apart from what the administration sees as the answer to the problems of cities caught in a budget crunch. Following the mayor's testimony, Treasury Secretary William Simon told the committee that New York is able to avoid default, but it must first regain investors' confidence by displaying what he called tough fiscal reform measures. Simon expressed a basic fear on the part of the administration that to bail out New York would result in too much federal control over local budgets.
Although the challenges and the task are great, New York City, with the assistance of the state, has both the mechanisms and the resources to avoid default. Second, if a default were to occur, the event would be primarily legal in nature. The political and social infrastructure of the city would remain intact. Third, while a default could adversely affect the capital markets, the effect, in my judgment, would be tolerable and temporary. Fourth, a default would cause little, if any, damage to our financial structure. The banking system would remain intact. No bank customers would lose their deposits, and the system would continue to be able to provide credit to all levels of the economy, including consumers. Finally, the costs and risks associated with any program to provide special federal financial assistance to prevent default substantially outweigh the benefits which prevention would provide. At the President's request, I've put together an informal interagency task force chaired by my Undersecretary, Ed Yeo, to deal with every aspect of a potential default by New York City. The evaluations and the plans outlined in my testimony are a result of these efforts. Working through this group and with the cooperation of other agencies of government, we've developed a program designed specifically to minimize harm in the event of a default. To complement action by the state legislature, we've prepared and will shortly submit to the Congress legislation amending Chapter 9 of the Federal Bankruptcy Act to facilitate use of the protections of that act by New York City. In addition, we're also studying the feasibility of a Chapter 11 type reorganization. We will continue to provide for the flow of federal assistance payments to New York. To protect the banking system and thus assure the continued availability of resources that system provides to consumers, corporations, and governments, the FDIC will, in appropriate cases, provide capital to institutions where such action is necessary to maintain their solvency. Moreover, as Chairman Burns reported to this committee, the Federal Reserve will act promptly to relieve liquidity strains on the banking system, whatever the cause of those strains may be. Let me repeat, default can be avoided, but it is our responsibility to the Congress and to the nation to design programs for any eventuality.
The ranking members of the Joint Economic Committee are not impressed with Treasury Secretary Salmon's solution to the financial problems of cities. Committee Chairman Senator Hubert Humphrey.
You want to amend the Bankruptcy Act? Great. Jolly. What's that going to do for anybody? Secondly, you say that default is a cure. This is the same thing as saying that unemployment is a cure for inflation. It runs all the way through this administration's type of ideology, economic ideology. In other words, if you're in trouble, just hit the dirt. Don't try to get a safety net out. Don't try to rescue. Mr. Simon, I've heard this again. I've heard very prominent people in this government say that when there's enough unemployment, it'll cure inflation. Sure it will, if you got anybody left. There's a good deal of argument here about what kind of restraints ought to be put on municipalities. I noticed that you said that submitting to federal control, if we have federal legislation, it will mean submitting to federal control or to pay the price of independence in the bond market. Well, Mr. Simon, I was the mayor of the city and I had to submit to state control. And I didn't see one bit of difference between that and being submitting to federal control. In fact, I used to get a lot more help out of the federal government than I did out of the state. And the state of New York has made it very clear that it is going to impose controls on the city of New York. Nor do I think that is wrong. You have been in this bonding business and brokerage business and banking business. I've never seen a banker yet that ever loaned you a dime that didn't want some controls on you. He either wants all your collateral or he wants to put a member on your board. When did that get to be such a bad practice? If the federal government has to have insured loans or guaranteed loans or a type of reconstruction finance corporation loan or emergency loan, of course there will be some restraints. That's exactly the way it ought to be. And I imagine that you as a participant in the World Bank, and you're a big one, you got 70% of the stock, I imagine that you insist upon some controls on loans, don't you? Isn't that right? Isn't the World Bank, doesn't our governor on that bank insist upon some kind of organized control over the fiscal policies of the countries that are benefited by the World Bank?
It depends on the type of loan. We have different criteria depending on the
course.
Loan. And the answer is yes, and indeed there should be. I'd like to respond.
All right. Well, wait a minute. Are you saying that this means that the little countries that are helped by the World Bank are somehow or another having their sovereignty destroyed and they have their independence destroyed? To the contrary. You testified before committee after committee that this is sensible, prudent fiscal policy.
Yeah, but there's a difference between what the World Bank does, Mr. Chairman. The World Bank provides project loans for development and for self-help in these countries.
Well, my good friend, it isn't so different. It's money. Money is money. It's just a question of whether you do it for the projects or whether you, if you do it for projects, you don't have to then do so much for operating. Most of us have been around, you know.
And you say that.
And we know whether money is money.
And you say there's no difference between state control and federal control. Well, I think the Constitution says that there's quite a difference.
No, there's no difference when the controls are on, Mr. Simon. You've never been mayor of a city. I have. And I can tell you that a control is a control. I don't care whether it's wrapped in the federal insignia or the state insignia. It's a control. Now, what do you propose for this city except bankruptcy or default if the situation gets to a point where they cannot finance their bonds and where they cannot get operating funds? You heard the mayor of the city of New York here say that he's got to borrow $1 billion before revenues come in. And what if they foreclose that? And I listen to all this business about the tax-exempt bonds and the bonds that are taxable. And I find that our study reveals that margin has been closing consistently. That the interest rates on so-called tax exempts is getting closer and closer to the interest rates on taxable bonds. And it's gone from 62% up to 75%. And Mr. Secretary, as I listen to your testimony here today, and you're now going to have your time to respond, all I sense is that you have said that the administration will amend the Bankruptcy Act, number one. Number two, that you'll take care of the banks. In other words, don't worry about the folks in the cities, we'll take care of the banks. I've heard some of that stuff in my younger life, and I didn't like it then, and I like it less now. And number three, that default is a cure. That's right. A heart attack is a cure too, you know, if you live through it. But sometimes they have medication to kind of tide you over. And I'd like to have your response to what I consider to be a totally negative presentation on the part of the administration.
I hardly know where to begin, Mr. Chairman.
Well, begin with a proposal besides bankruptcy. That's no alternative.
You cannot find, either in direct statement or by implication, where I stated or implied that default is a cure for New York City. On the contrary, I said that default can be avoided if the tough political steps, and I emphasize that several times, and they are tough political decisions, are made. The point is that when we make the comparisons in the municipal market of a prime municipal versus a prime corporate, comparing the taxable and tax-exempt securities, which is the only comparison to the subsidy that we give, effectively, due to the tax exemption, prime municipal versus prime corporate is at 70%. Now, within the various rating categories, you're going to have, as I said at the outset of my testimony, certain large cities like New York who finance an extraordinary amount that are certainly going to pay a higher interest cost of the supply of the issues. People demand a higher rating with the other concerns that they have for the city.
We are not here today to find villains for New York City's malaise or to absolve those who are responsible. I think the mayor's made it clear that there undoubtedly have been cities and states, including the federal government, that could enjoy much better management. There's already been enough talk and rhetoric on both sides, and there's plenty of responsibility to be shared by all city officials, state officials, bankers, city employees, and even residents themselves. Mayor Alexander of Syracuse had some very powerful testimony, pointing out that New York City bonds are in the main held by ordinary citizens who have used these bonds as a means of saving for purposes of education of their children and retirement. And my point is, I'd like to be as interested in New York City as the International Monetary Fund was recently in the development of the developing world. And believe me, as the chairman of the Committee on Foreign Assistance, if we don't get some action, we're going to put it right on foreign assistance someplace along the line, because we're just not going to have an example of saving a city in Afghanistan and letting a city go down the drain in New York.
Senator Humphrey's rejection of the administration's proposal for assisting cities with financial problems is echoed by the ranking Republican on the Joint Economic Committee, Senator Jacob Javits of New York.
You're writing the policy. That's what the president is echoing. And that's it, as far as the nation is concerned, in the national administration. So I ask you now, you say in your statement at the very beginning, personally, I am confident that if the proper steps are taken, default will be avoided. Well, I read you the steps that have been taken. Now, what added steps do you propose that New York take to avoid default? And when you bear in mind, Mr. Secretary, bearing in mind and what you now tell us as to what New York must do, the fact that the mayor says we can't pay our bills from November to March, we simply won't have the money, short by $1 billion.
First of all, Senator Javits, it is not the responsibility nor any requirement set forth by the federal government as to what New York City should or must do to regain access to the financial markets. It's the market's requirements. And what they have to do is present, first and foremost, which I'm told they're going to on October the 15th, finally, a credible budget that will explain to the investors around the country and the financial community a plan, whether it's over 1, 2, or 3 years, that is going to balance the budget, that is going to stop the accounting gimmicks that they used for years, moving operating expenses into the capital budget, where this year they have over $700 million of operating expenses in the capital budget, as you know. This is first and foremost and the most important requirement that they can perform as far as regaining access to the marketplace. I must admit that, as I've said over and over again, that if fiscal and financial credibility is restored by presenting a balanced budget, They'll have access to the market.
Well, Mr. Secretary, the United States guarantees some $83 billion in FHA mortgages. And the United States guarantees brokerage accounts up to $50,000 through an insurance company which has been organized for the purpose. And the United States guarantees tens of billions of dollars of savings banks deposits. And it offers hurricane insurance, and it offers many other things. Now, these are all last resort propositions. Why not for the cities? Why not for the cities? Why are the cities the exception you cut out to which absolutely, flatly, inevitably, and irrevocably, the United States will offer no last resort help whatever? Why?
So I said in my testimony, Senator Javits, that we would be creating a new security. Potential exposure would be $50-60 billion a year, because we must assume that would be the maximum amount that would come to the federal government for the privilege of borrowing with a federal guarantee.
Recorded defaults by local government occurred in Mobile, Alabama in 1838. During the two decades prior to the Civil War, 19 local governments defaulted on their obligations. These were caused by bank failures and a tight money market. 2 years ago, the Advisory Commission on Intergovernmental Relations released a report entitled City Financial Emergencies. The author of the commission report is Philip Dearborn, a former finance director for the city of Cleveland and presently director of the Municipal Research Bureau here in Washington. Dearborn discussed some of the indicators of a city on the brink of default.
First of all, it would be an operating fund in which the revenues are less than expenditures by a significant amount in one fiscal year, or in which the revenues are less than expenditures by a smaller amount over several years. Excess of current liabilities over current assets, overall financial condition of the city is in a deficit position. Short-term operating loans outstanding at the end of a fiscal year, and a high and rising rate of property tax delinquency, or a sudden and substantial decrease in the assessed value, the base upon which the property tax is levied, for some unexpected reason. Now, as we looked at the history of financial emergencies in the past, we found that generally one or all of those conditions were present and precipitated the financial emergency. From that, we concluded that these were the danger signals to watch for if we want to guard against any emergencies in the future. And we did test the 30 largest cities in the country, and we did find that most of them were pretty healthy by those standards, with some of them, such as New York, meeting several of the criteria that warranted concern. And the New York situation has, I think, verified the basic significance of these as indicators of financial trouble.
What happens when a city or local government actually defaults on its obligations?
It's a little bit different than what happens when a company like Penn Central does or some of the other examples of private bankruptcy. From what we've been able to see in the history of these types of occurrences, and it looks to me like the same thing will happen with New York, the city will eventually come out of its problems, will regain its financial health, and by that I mean they will start operating on a basis in which their annual revenues equal their annual expenditures. The biggest problem New York City has right now, they're moving towards that. They've laid off substantial numbers of employees, they've increased their taxes, and they're headed towards a balancing of revenues and expenditures. It's going to be difficult, but I think they're going to get there. The problem they've got is what to do with this $6 billion of debt that they let accumulate over a period of years, and that it has to be paid back. And the only answer to that seems to be some plan by which they can pay that back over the next 10 or 15 years, because they certainly can't pay back $6 billion in 1 year. The latest approach to it, and it happens to be the one we recommended in the study, is that the state legislature will, in effect, authorize a takeover of the city by a state agency. In this case, the state agency is going to be controlled by the governor and the state controller, but with representation by the mayor and the city auditor. But that agency will take charge of the city's finances. We'll bring the revenues and expenditures into balance, and we'll assure the people who are owed that $6 billion that in some orderly way they will get repaid the amount that's owed, and I think probably the amount that's owed with full interest on it. You have to realize New York is still a very healthy economic entity. There's tremendous wealth in New York, both from a property tax base and from an income and sales tax standpoint, which are the three major revenue producers in New York City. It looks to me like that this is a problem of management, and it can be brought under control. There's going to be some dislocations of employees, of services. It's going to be some hardship on the people living in New York, but I think they'll manage.
Now, earlier you stated that one of the problems leading to a default by some city governments is poor fiscal management. But what about the consideration that maybe possibly defaults may just be an indication of overall poor state of the economy nationally, and also the fact that there's a need for, say, fiscal reform on the part of the local governments and how they carry out different social service programs?
Well, there are two different aspects of this problem. There is the one which is purely a matter of fiscal management. That's a budgeting, making ends meet type of situation. Just as a family or an individual has this problem, that means adjusting your expenditures to live within what you perceive to be your income, or the amount you have to spend. There are some very poor cities in the country today which are not in bankruptcy and not in any danger. They don't provide very good services, but they're liquid and they're not in any danger. That's one part of the problem. The second part of the problem is who's going to take care of the people in New York City who need health services, who need welfare, who need education? And who's going to assume this responsibility for people that come into a New York City or Washington from all over the country and who in many instances are poor and have little to contribute to the local economy, at least for some period of time? I believe, and I think a lot of others do, that this is a national problem. It involves, to some extent, redistribution of wealth. It involves a national responsibility for such things as welfare and probably for health care. And that part of the problem is a vital concern to the cities. But it is separate and apart from this question of fiscal management. There are a lot of cities in the country, most major cities, are having little problem with their fiscal management. But almost universally, they're having a problem right now with unemployment, with health care, and with all of these other problems that are characteristic of central cities.
Based upon the Commission's survey of previous defaults and financial emergencies in local governments, how soon do you suspect that we'll see New York recover from its financial burdens right now?
Well, I think within the next year, there will be some kind of a plan developed to stabilize the existing rather chaotic financial situation in New York. And the plan will essentially provide for repaying this debt, for getting out from under the $6 billion over an extended period of time. That's what the Big Mac Corporation was all about, and that's what the new plan of the governors and the legislatures is all about. Once stability is achieved, which should take place within the next year, then there will be a period of very tight budget stringency over probably the next 10 or 15 years in New York City. And this will mean a lot of people looking over their shoulder at New York to make sure that they really balance their budget, that they don't spend a dollar more than they take in each year. I think we can expect for a long while that the New York mayors are going to have a lot of people watching everything they do. And that will be for a long period of time, and it will limit the the flexibility of elected officials, and it'll limit the services in the city quite severely.
Is this based on the assumption that New York will submit to default before it regains its fiscal solvency?
Well, the question of submitting to default, I think, has been overblown. For all practical purposes, the city has been in a form of receivership now since last spring. It may not have been formalized to the extent of an actual default in a bankruptcy proceeding, but there hasn't been any question that the mayor and the elected officials in New York were not controlling events, that they were being dictated to by outside outside interests, the Big Mac Corporation, the bankers, the state officials. What now seems to be happening, I think, is a rather healthier development in which the state legislature and the governor, elected officials at the state level, are going to come in and actually formalize some type of a trusteeship or receivership for the city. This will, it seems to me, place the responsibility where it rightfully belongs in elected state officials and make them accountable for resolving the problem.
In your workings with the D.C. Municipal Research Bureau, do you draw any conclusions that the fact that what is happening to New York City may be a tip of the overall municipal iceberg that most cities are going through in terms of budget deficits?
Yes, I think in two ways. Both my experience in Washington and in Cleveland and in seeing other cities, I do draw two parallels. One is the continuing overriding importance of good financial management. This has to be done in a city. It may be difficult, but it has to be done to protect the integrity of that city's finances and that city's government. The second problem is that cities are just facing a very unmanageable situation with the responsibility for carrying the load of the unemployed, of the sick, of the uneducable or undereducated, of all of the problems that we see in a central city today. It's an almost overwhelming problem for city officials to have to face, and they really will have to have some kind of relief if this keeps up for much longer.
Philip Dearborn, a former finance director for the city of Cleveland and presently director of the Municipal Research Bureau in Washington. The overall effects of a national recession, nonstop inflation, and record rates of unemployment have slashed the bottom out of many city budgets. But worse than these ill forces has been the deteriorating revenue base of many cities, caused by an exodus of a white middle class to the suburbs and the immigration of poor and low-income persons into the cities. An example of this is most acutely reflected in New York in its efforts to prevent default. New York has adopted a 3-month rescue plan which will keep the city's budget in the black until the end of November. After that, Mayor Beam says that the city will not be able to avoid default without some kind of federal assistance. Some observers are hoping that during these intervening months, Congress and the White House will come to grips with a plan to assist not only New York, but other cities on the brink of default. It is also hoped that New York's financial nightmare will prompt Washington to take a second look at the concept of federalism and carefully assess the state of American cities.
If the proper steps are taken, default is going to be avoided.
Now, Denver's a long way from the city of New York, but we're in the same financial building.
And can we really draw the line at New York City? I doubt it.
That isn't so.
Submit to federal control or pay the price of independence in the bond markets.
Mr. Secretary, this is not how an efficiently functioning free market should operate.
73% of all of your revenues come out of these big cities.
We need to meet what is a national urban crisis.
You've been listening to a report on the financial problems of cities. The report was written and produced by NPR reporter Bill Gray. Funding for Options is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. For Options, I'm Mike Waters. This is NPR, National Public Radio.